Okay, great. Thanks everyone for coming. Thanks for braving the rain. I understand that understand from Liz that when it rains, sometimes the numbers are depleted in the room. So well done everyone for braving the weather. Also a special hello to the 300 people joining on the webinar, or maybe it's three people. I don't, you never quite know, but wherever you are, if you're in the room on the webinar, very much intended to be a sort of a two-way discussion as much as we can make it. So yeah, do jump in at any time with discussions and comments, observations, criticisms, what have you. So this is a double header. So the title is "How to Lose Your Shirt in Health Insurance," and we're presenting a presentation here today, and then the same session in Melbourne in a week or two. So they are intended to be the same discussion. So no need to feel you need to go to both, unless you want to. So what's this all about? I guess the questions it's trying to answer is what causes financial distress for health insurers? So how does health insurers get into trouble? And I guess financial distress in a broad term. So rather than assets below liabilities or breaching the regulatory capital requirements, it's sort of financial peril, financial danger, the sort of situations where the regulator is starting to spend a lot of time in your office. And I guess the purpose for that, although you know it's sort of interesting to a point in itself, the point is that to think about how to build financial readiness and resilience. Why has this been put together? And you might have seen there was an Actuaries Digital article. This is really just the same material, but in a forum where we can have a discussion about it. It's intended just to inform discussion about these things. Also to inform discussion about regulatory capital requirements, so why we have the capital requirements we have and the strengths and weaknesses of those, and also to draw out some differences to general insurance. So I guess we're quite a dynamic practice area in health insurance. We're a practice area where you know, very few people have worked exclusively in this practice area or continue to. We're an area where people come in from other areas. We have a regulator that's new to our industry. And obviously there's a lot of similarities to general insurance, and then there's a lot of things that are different. So just by sort of dwelling on those and having a discussion about those would be helpful to people who work across different industries or supervise different industries. So there were four people who had a hand in this. So Hayden, Matt Crane, Andrew Matthews, and Jamie Reid. You'll notice that they're not here today. So Hayden and Andrew Matthews are going to do the Melbourne session. And yeah, Matt Crane couldn't make it today, unfortunately. So I suppose, you know, what we're talking about today, at most a quarter of it is my own, although I did put the slides together. So if they don't make sense, that's on me. I guess also, I mean, it'd be fair to say there's not a lot of original research or thought in this. Really what this is a gathering together of existing research and sort of a representation of that to have discussion. So how's that go for size? Not too bad. So the contents: what has caused recent stresses in health insurance? How does that compare to general insurance? A quick look at regulatory requirements, which scanning around the room, I suspect, you know, we don't need to talk about too much on. Capital management, and then a couple of conclusions and discussion points. So what causes stresses in PHI? And I suppose what I'm talking about now is a study that was done by THEAC a number of years ago. So they thought of 14 companies that they considered had got into distress between 2000 and 2012. And for each of those 12, they had to think about what caused it. And they came up with a list of factors. So obviously, in some cases, there was more than one factor, so they tick more than one box. But there's 14 companies studied. And I guess also that there's obviously any study like this is a little bit judgmental. You know, what were the causes? And I suppose there's layers to causes sometimes. So if the cause was pricing or being underpriced, you know, what was the cause of underpricing? Was it technical? Was it, and so on and so on. So having put all those caveats on it, though, I think it still is an interesting exercise that the regulator did to sort of step back and say, well, 14 cases of trouble, what are the themes, what are the causes? So presenting that back. So I guess I'm just going to start with some the sort of high-level categories of causes and then sort of drill into a couple of them. So here's the four high-level causes. So underpricing is a contributing factor. So FEAC thought that was a factor in every case. So in each of the 14, it was underpriced. Capital management was a contributing factor in 80%, so 80% of that 14. Rapid membership growth was a factor in 70%, and membership shrinking was a factor in 10%. So what's that? That would be one or two, I suppose. I guess also, I mean, sort of take it in the spirit that it's intended in that I suppose, you know, any insolvency of any company could be due to underpricing because, you know, if you set your prices high enough and your capital targets high enough, you could withstand any storm. But I guess the analysis was that, look, you know, the prices really should, with hindsight, have been higher, or something different should have been done with capital as distinct to, you know, capital could have mitigated the situation. So just digging into underpricing. So within the underpricing, so all of them had underpricing. What specifically was it that was wrong? So for more than 80% of those cases, the issue was new things. So there was an underestimation of benefits for new products or new markets or new policyholders. Perhaps the legacy business, the members of longstanding, was priced okay, but something new had come along and that wasn't well priced. Again, more than 80% did not reflect all the drivers of experience, such as duration impacts. So as most people in this room know, that's the low claims costs in the first year during waiting periods, and then perhaps a catch-up in the next year before coming to some sort of mature state. So perhaps the prices were okay for a mature state, but hadn't allowed for some of these impacts. Government intervention in pricing comes up 6 times out of 10. I guess have in mind here, this is a study over the period, you know, 2000 to 2012. So in that period, there were some years where the government said no price increase or low price increase or some sort of invention. So this is not necessarily a sort of run-of-the-mill sort of small adjustments, everybody please resubmit. This is a more significant adjustment. And with the underpricing, I guess it's interesting to see the bottom one. So intentional underpricing, loss leaders, if you like, I suppose, is sort of a minority of these cases. So it's more likely to be intentional underpricing, unintentional underpricing than intentional. The next one is digging below capital management. So that was a factor in more than 8 out of 10 of these. And I guess the distinction to make here is it's not so much the thin capital targets. So setting a capital target which, with hindsight, you know, was just too skinny to withstand the storms. It was about did people follow their capital management policies and practices? So, you know, maybe the target was okay, but when things started to go bad, it wasn't picked up quickly enough for monitoring. The responses weren't strong enough. Maybe there weren't the most trigger points or so on. So I guess interesting that sort of the regulator drew that distinction in the capital issues. It's more likely to be about management of capital position than simply not having enough capital. So putting that all together, what caused recent stresses? So weaknesses in pricing, 14 out of 14, coupled with membership growth, coupled with capital management problems. So if you've come here to find out how to lose your shirt in health insurance, then maybe that's your answer. You know, it's weak pricing while growing quickly without strong capital management practices. And if you've got that thing, and if something happens in the government setting then, so if, you know, you're sitting there with your weak pricing, you're growing quickly, and your capital management isn't where it should be, and then there's a government change, so either a policy change that drives membership or perhaps an intervention in pricing process, then you add that in the mix, then that's the recipe, it seems, or has been in the past for losing your shirt. But I guess at this point it's worth sort of noting what's not there. So, you know, if that's the recipe, then sort of what's not in the mix? It's not investment losses. So FIAC says it was a secondary role in one case. And it's not provisioning. It's not outstanding claims. So that's a minor role in one case. So in a way, sort of what's not there is as interesting as what is. Yeah, sure. Now, let me give you a microphone. For the benefits of the hundreds online.
Gosh, and Robert Thompson from APRA. Did the study draw any distinctions between sort of established insurers and problems they had and perhaps startup insurers? Do you know? Or were there no startups in there? Or?
Oh, not that I know. I guess from memory, maybe there were some startups in there. I guess, you know, there's people in the room. So did you want to answer, Gail?
There would be a maximum of 2 startups in there.
Great.
Wearing my old regulator hat, there would have been a maximum of 2 startups in that. Most of those were existing insurers.
I suppose, yeah, that would make sense, wouldn't it, given the number of startups in the industry. Yes. Okay. So now we're comparing to GI, and we've got a similar table setting out the reasons. I guess this is based on... this isn't based on an APRA study or a regulator's study. It's based on, you know, various papers that have been written over time about why general insurers fail. And again, sort of drawing out what's not there. So what you won't see on the list is government decisions causing general insurers to fail, government changes to policy settings. That's not there as a principal factor. Okay, so... Your slide's getting slightly messier. So principal risks to general insurers. We've got on this slide catastrophic events, inadequate provisions, inadequate premiums given the product design, and rapid growth. And there's some more on the next slide. And then we're saying, well, is each a risk for PHI? Or principal risk, I guess in theory, you know, any of these factors could get you into trouble. Is it a principal risk? And then some comments. I guess the other observation is, you know, we're talking about general insurance here as if it's, you know, a homogenous thing, whereas, of course, you know, all of us know it's far, far from the truth. You know, there are some insurers, some general insurers who are, you know, very much akin to health insurers in their risk, and then there's some at the other end of the spectrum that have almost nothing in common with health insurers, and then there's everything in between. But sort of putting that aside, is catastrophic events a principal risk for general insurers? Absolutely. There's some that's appetite. They exist in business to fund catastrophes, and sort of thinking back to sort of my work overseas, I mean, sort of doing work at Lloyd's and the sort of results you see, you know, sort of some years you'd get a single-digit claim ratio, and then the next year it might be 200%, and then the next year it's maybe you're not there, but maybe you're working for someone else, and there's something else there. So catastrophes is very much the way those companies will leave the world. But in health insurance, that's really not a risk, I suppose. And I guess when you start to think about, well, what is the catastrophe? What is the single event that could hurt a health insurer? It's really quite hard to think of something. Inadequate provisions, well, that can be a big risk for general insurers, and likewise inadequate premiums. I guess the issue is that when a general insurer gets their prices wrong, it could be a number of years before that sort of becomes apparent. And when it does become apparent that you're underpriced, not only do you perhaps have a long way to go in adjusting the premiums for your new business, but all the reserves that have accumulated for years and years of business may turn out to be understated and need to be revised. And all of that obviously goes to capital, all that restatement of reserves. So I guess sort of flip forward to general insurance. The provisions are not a significant proportion of annual claim costs, and if underpricing is there, then it can be identified and it can be fixed. And in fact, you don't even have to wait to the next annual pricing round. You can make a product change or a contracting change or some change with very short notice. And all this needs to be kept in mind, I guess, when you're thinking about regulatory capital requirements and capital targets. So I guess that's where we're shooting towards. Rapid growth we put as a risk for both sections. The risks here, maybe these are a little bit more exotic in some ways. So the top the top one is significant change in business. And I suppose this links to the third one, impaired affiliate. So if you go and sort of study general insurance, bankruptcies, insolvencies, what have you, you know, sometimes it might be the business was writing 10, 20, 30, 40 different products, and maybe it had lots of subsidiaries doing things. And sometimes it's, you know, one of those products goes wrong, or one of those subsidiaries gets into trouble, and there's a sort of contagion through the company. And I suppose, you know, it is possible that you could imagine health insurance in that mix. But in Australia, it's harder to see it, I suppose, as most health insurers are monoline or, you know, have very simple businesses aligned to them. And they don't tend to be part of these complex groups. So maybe that's not a point that's so much of about the nature of health insurance, but the corporate structures of Australian health insurers. Misstated accounts and fraud, well, I guess that's always a possible cause. But I guess compared to general insurers, health insurers often have relatively simple accounts. There's fewer areas of judgment or complexity. The financial accounts and the sort of cash accounts tend to be more similar than with some of the more exotic general insurance businesses. And reinsurance, I guess, is something we don't have to worry about either.
That's something that needs to be remembered.
Yeah.
Depending on the size of your insurer and the amount of HRB. But with some insurers having more and more HRB, it's certainly something to watch.
Yeah, and acknowledge that, Rob, absolutely. And I guess, you know, some businesses are a lot more complex than others. Some businesses have got huge product ranges now. Some have got, you know, they're in healthcare. So there are sort of ancillary risks and agree that they need to be thought of. But I suppose they're generalising here, of course, a degree of complexity less than, you know, the a typical general insurer, if there is such a thing. I guess this is sort of a filler slide, I suppose, that's linking the sort of risks to capital and to profit. One of the beautiful things about four people writing a paper together is that we all sort of come to it with our own favourite graphs and tables and our own favourite sort of most important points that need to be put in. And so if you read the paper, I guess you've just got my take today, but if you read the paper, you know, you sort of see a little flavour of everybody's favourite topics, and I won't tell you whose favourite this one was. But I guess the point is, if you do have some of those long-tail general insurance classes where, you know, if you get your prices wrong, you've got to restate several years of claims, then you need a lot of capital. So for a typical liability or CTP portfolio, the amount of capital you might hold is 80 to 90% of premium, perhaps, give or take. So because you've got that much capital, you do need a substantial profit margin on your policies. So perhaps you do need a 20% margin on your liability business to service that capital that's at risk. If you go somewhere in the middle, so commercial property or home insurance, then again, you've got some risk there. You've got the catastrophe risk in particular. Some of those claims might take a little while to develop. So if those businesses, you might need 30% of premium as capital, give or take, and you'd need a reasonable margin to service that. I guess how much capital should an insurer need? It's a, you know, an open question, and there's a very different ranges of practice out there. The large for-profits, of which there are two, typically target capital of about 13 to 14% of premium, and the profit margins have been reasonably high. But I guess you can see, and I suppose there's an actual profit column there to say, well, not everybody necessarily gets their target. But you can see a trend there between, you know, some of these risk factors, the amount of capital needed and the amount of profit.
Jamie, did you want to talk about 7 divided by 13?
No. I suppose if you were to talk about it, I suppose there are industries where return on capital doesn't make sense. So if you have very thin capital, then you're not really earning a return on the capital in the bank. You're earning a return on assets like brand and your ability to distribute and your IP and product development and so on. So what would Google's return on capital be, or a lot of these dot-com businesses that don't trade on financial capital but trade on intellectual property and IP? And I guess my sense is that some of these very light, very capital-light insurance distribution businesses, if you're just looking at return on capital, you're really not getting a broad picture. You've probably got to look at a range of metrics. Okay, so this is a very simple... I guess we're sort of changing gear here. So the first part of this is to say, well, look, what are the risks in health insurance and how does that compare to general insurance? And I guess, as I said, the purpose of doing that is to try and make sense of why our regulatory capital requirements are as they are, why they appear to be a lot lower than other industries, and sort of similarly, why the amount of capital insurers actually hold is what it is. And I guess there's sort of a range of practices here as well. For those who don't work in the industry, and perhaps there's not too many in this room, here's a very quick rundown on our capital requirements. So capital, I guess, for a health insurer is everything gets counted, including intangibles. And then there's two tests that are performed. So the tests are similar. So first of all, you put some margins on your liabilities. That's called prudent liabilities. And that's in red there. The next one in green is a stress test. So that's a judgmental analysis of underwriting risk and investment risk, which is performed by the insurer's actuary. So stepping back, I should have said that the prudent liabilities is formula driven, so it's formulae set out by the regulator. I suppose that is similar to GI. The stress test is not similar to GI. And then the operational risk is a sort of formula driven charge. The only difference with the other test is it says, well, look, let's keep that prudent liabilities, that stress liabilities piece, and add on what's called the maximum default loss, which is your largest single counterparty exposure. So essentially the regulatory test is to work out all those numbers, add them together in the combination shown, and to make sure that you have at least as much capital to meet the maximum of those tests. And I guess, I mean, there was a lot of thinking done at the time around by the regulator, not by me, to developing a test which is relevant to the risks faced by general insurers. So you don't see explicit catastrophe charges there. There's not a lot of capital typically for reserving risk and so on. I guess a second part of APRA's or FEAC's test was to put regulations around capital management. And I suppose that links back to the causes of failure study, which FEAC did, which said it's not necessarily the amount of capital that is an issue, it's the practices to manage that. So there's a requirement to have capital in excess of the regulatory requirement enforced via the requirement to have a CMP, a requirement that the CMP has targets and trigger points. And I guess in theory you could have a CMP that sort of had all the target and the trigger point equal to the regulatory minimum, but sort of implicitly through the requirement to have all these things, so targets, trigger points, responses, and so on, implicit in that is a regulatory requirement to hold significantly in excess of the regulatory minimum, which of course all insurers do. An observation there that the policies are potentially more important than the amount of capital being held and the management responses there. So this is a conclusion. So what's the driver of failure in PHI? Historically, it's been a consistent set of factors, pricing, growth, and capital management. And government decisions have sometimes played a significant role in compounding those factors. Comparison to GI, well, I guess the main observation is that many significant issues for general insurance, catastrophes and reserves and so on, so significant things that drive the capital needs of general insurers are just not apparent in PHI. What are the implications? Well, the implications is health insurers need forward-looking tools to set capital targets and triggers. They're inherently subjective in nature, and they result in capital targets significantly in excess of the regulatory minimum. So with Andrew, Hayden and Matt, here's our little list of some suggested discussion areas, and I guess that's the, as I said at the start, that's what I'm hoping we'll get to today. So what drives pricing errors? Is it technical issues, or is it an inherent bias that might come from time to time? What drives capital problems? Is it a poor capital management policy, or is it failure to follow capital management policy? What about some of the key relationships? Is there a link between the strength of those relationships and instances of financial distress? And then the move to APRA, which seems like old news now. It was quite a number of months ago that it happened now. What should we expect this move will have on capital management over time? And will APRA's focus on risk management help mitigate some of the drivers of failure? So I'm hoping that there'll be lots of discussions, and who would like to kick us off? Yeah, go for it, Rob. Yeah.
The data was from 2000 to 2012. Do you think the industry now is in a materially better position in relation to financial controls and capital management, pricing, etc., than it was over that period?
Well, gee, I'm not sure I'm necessarily qualified to say, as I'm a relative newcomer to the industry, being less than 10 years. I don't know. I mean, you'd like to hope so. With the introduction of the new standard, some of the modelling around that, the very strong capital positions of many insurers. But I guess another observation is the industry has had a pretty benign time over recent years as participation has grown. Recently, benign inflation, has some memory as some corporate memory of difficult times and stress times been lost in organisations. You know, when the next difficult times come, and who knows, are they imminent? Are they many years off? Will there be the people there with corporate memory in this industry or others who've seen bad times and know how to react? So there's a non-answer for you.
Can I just add, is it fair to say that quite a few of those financial stresses happened towards the the earlier end of 2000, you know, right after Dutton Pulp Cover and the rebate and the significant growth in membership, and there was probably less actuaries in this room around at that time as well, and the less formal role of the appointed actuary or the actuary played in the process. You know, do you think that was perhaps a contributor to some of these stresses, or are we still have similar risks now?
Yeah, I don't know, and interested to hear from others. I guess an observation I made at a meeting before was, over 10 years ago, I was working in the UK in general insurance, and I've sort of observed before that all our work there was after the event. So you'd wait. So quite often, you know, there'd be some sort of crisis, and you'd go into the company and you'd help pick up the pieces. You'd help calculate how much they'd lost, and observe before that you know, a lot of our work in this room is very much before the event. It's thinking about, you know, what could go wrong. It's through notifiable circumstances, you know, people speaking to you before decisions are made and saying, look, Jamie, we're thinking about this. What do you think about this? And I guess my experience is, you know, I mean, they're always interesting conversations. It's very rare that you say, oh, it's sort of you have an opportunity to put the red flag up and make a representation before things go wrong. And I think that's a very powerful tool in our armoury that might help us down the track.
Yeah, just to answer the first one, I suppose, what drives pricing errors? I think we have been through a period of fairly benign, or rather benign environment, but I think from what we're seeing is that's changing. It's changing quite dramatically. The availability of information for people, the impact of the aggregators. You can't now be an insurer sitting out, you know, in regional Australia, insuring, you know, the people within a 30-mile radius of you. Your rates are on the internet. People look for you. You get the Canstar awards and all these sorts of things. So I just think that what drives pricing errors is just getting your pricing wrong for the risk that's going to take that product. You know, Medibank's losing 3% of its membership in a year. That's a lot of members that have got to go somewhere else. And most of them are, you know, adverse selection in turning up in other funds and things like that. So I think certainly from an actuary's point of view, you need to be on your guard at the moment, because it's changed. I think the industry's changing, and changing quite rapidly from where it's been. Inherent bias, I don't see a lot of that, to be honest, management incentives and things like that in this industry. But, you know, there's still people want to grow for growth's sake. There's still, you know, 30-odd funds out there, and some of them want to be bigger than what they are. So I think, you know, that's always going to be an issue. But to your point, Jamie, I think the notifiable circumstances is a fantastic, you know, instrument in this industry. You do get notified, you know, before it's going to happen, and often, as you say, it's a phone call. What do you think about this? And that gives the actuary the opportunity to raise, you know, a lot of issues around pricing and those sorts of things. So. The other thing I think that's really helped a lot is the capital management, and particularly having a target and triggers. And again, a lot of insurers are really looking at that. And, you know, if they breach their target, you know, the target to coverage ratio of whatever it is, 1.8 to 2, as soon as they get down towards 1.8 now, we're seeing, you know, boards are reacting to that, management's reacting to that. So there is very much, you know, through that process, you know, very much a fail-safe sort of, you know, mechanism that, you know, insurers are really, really looking to that. So I think there's, you know, there's a lot of things built into the system now that work, but the risks are certainly there, if not increasing in some areas.
Yeah. Thanks, David. Who'd like to continue the discussion or tilt it somewhere else? And Stuart?
I worked with Ian Harper a couple of years ago on the pricing paper Medibank put up as a white paper on the whole pricing process. When Ian looked at our industry, he felt very strongly that the pricing approval process was a support for the financially weakest in the industry, that the political price for saying to a very weak player, you cannot have that price increase, was very high. And while we know of some examples where that's not the case, it's still the impression that he had that one of the reasons why nobody goes bust is because everyone gets the price they ask for, with few exceptions. What do I conclude from that? Well, number one, it's really good to have an insurance sector where the customer's claims are never at risk. That really should be the way things are. Number two, therefore, in a well-run insurance industry, what should losing your shirt look like? Well, it should be more like an investor point of view, or perhaps the estate in a mutual becoming less and less able to sustain the business model. I think the paper here tends to cover where there's a real drama going on, and there's some policyholder claims at risk of not being paid. I think in the more normal insurance circumstance, the financial stresses are when the source of capital, the resulting profits, effectively the investor angle isn't being serviced properly.
Yeah, thanks, Stuart. I guess maybe I had more of an investor angle on it than came through, and maybe that's because it was myself and Andrew contributing. And I guess, no customers, no members were at risk during any of these events, I don't think, because their risks of getting close to the regulatory minimum, which is still above, which is still assets above liabilities, and then obviously there's a pool behind that. And I guess, if an insurer did go bust, you've got full portability still. You can travel on and get your claims paid. So I guess even in some of these bad cases, the members were okay, and I know sometimes FIAC would sort of arrange marriages for some of these institutions. So yeah, maybe no one was hurt, but I agree it's an important distinction. Sort of who loses their shirt? Is it the investor or the owner, or is it the policyholder?
Yeah, and the other part of Ian's expectation was that in a thriving industry, somebody would lose their shirt, right? The competition should make that happen.
Yes.
And in our efforts to ensure that no customer loses their shirt, we've also effectively started to ensure that nobody else loses their shirt either. And so if that was to change, then it might not be just specific pricing errors or specific capital problems. It might actually just be the sheer inability to compete, the expense margins consistently not being there and unable to price at that kind of level. It's just interesting that kind of more general competitive pressure doesn't appear on the tables.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question as well, isn't it? So it's not how to lose your shirt, but, does it matter if someone loses their shirt once in a while, provided no customers get hurt, or is it even healthy that happens? I suppose that's a different question. I suppose players have left the industry for various reasons. They've not necessarily left because they've run out of money, but because they saw that as a better option than continuing. Maybe that is a better way that people leave the industry. They see they can't compete, and then they exit rather than waiting.
Yeah, just further to that point, I suppose that's a fundamental difference between this industry and GI is portability. I suppose that brings into question, how much capital do you really need to hold as an industry if you do have portability, and if an insurer does fall over, then, they just walk across the road to the other insurer and renew their policies, whereas clearly, through the HIH debacle, we saw people just didn't have cover, which is quite a different thing. The other question, I suppose, if you're talking about investors losing their shirt, on one definition, you've only got two insurers where investors can lose their shirt, NIB and Medibank, as listed insurers. Obviously, there are other ones that are owned by other organisations. So again, I suppose the question is, what does losing your shirt mean for a not-for-profit mutual organisation, and how does that all fit into this discussion? I won't answer that.
Yeah, I suppose you see it in a range of practices with respect to capital targets, and maybe that's one. I suppose some people looking into the industry find it hard to understand. It's because there are some insurers with very low levels of capital and very high levels, that's necessarily something wrong, rather than indicating, you know, there's just a range of practices, different insurers, different backgrounds, different ability to raise capital, different risk appetite. And maybe that sort of explains some of that.
Yeah, because what's interesting is that people talk about the return on capital of the industry, which is running at, you know, for argument's sake, 20%. But if you actually take Bupa, Medibank and NIB out of that equation, it comes back to 10%.
Yeah. I guess the risk of getting off track. Just found any statistic about the industry average is becoming less and less useful over time as you know, there's a range of different business models in the industry. And the return on capital would be, you know, a prime example of that. Who's next up? Any questions from the web? Anyone there?
Can I ask a question? You talk about the 14 insurers that were investigated during the year 2010 to 12. I wonder, out of these 14, have they all survived? Or if they have, how did they survive?
Yeah, a little bit of this is beneath, sort of within the regulator's office. You know, some would be, I suppose if we turn off the microphones and put our heads together, we could probably guess most of the 14, but some of them would just be in the regulator's mind. And I guess it's quite a long period. So some would be ones that, you know, the regulator was concerned about and maybe did something behind the doors but was invisible outside. I guess there have been, and again, others might want to come in here. So no insurers have actually failed in that period. No insurers have gone insolvent. But I understand, you know, there's a couple that were you know, had to sell themselves in distressed circumstances. But, I mean, so the books sort of survive as part of larger insurers.
Through the minister's website, you can see premium increases of in the 10 to 15% range. Jamie, maybe more sometimes.
Yeah, so maybe it's fair to say they all survived, but some survived more than others, I suppose. Some of them just merged into oblivion. I'll go, Carl, I know.
There were 48 health funds when I came to the industry as a regulator. There are now 30. Some of them found friends and I arranged a few marriages.
Yeah, and beautiful. Some got married more than once. Okay, can I persuade anyone else to? Yeah, of course.
This is related to the REIT submission review last year. I remember the health minister required all the funds to do a resub, because she claimed that we all hold too much capital to support that high rate increase. So does that mean the drivers to lose our shirt relate to the capital is not relevant anymore? Or you have any other thought?
I don't know. I think, that was an example, although maybe a relatively benign example, of ministerial intervention in the process. If people put their best guess going forward, and then the minister says, we'll go a little lower because of capital or because there's a product change coming or a prosthesis change coming and so on, then maybe that's an example of some sort of intervention. I'd understand it was more severe interventions that caused some of those issues. I guess last year seemed more business as usual. So maybe it was the couple of years before that were unusually easy in terms of government response, and maybe last year was more of a normal year. I know one of the analysts, one of the investment analysts, went through a large number of years of price increases. Maybe they did 20. And then they worked out the average increase approved when it's an election year and the average increase when it's not an election year. And they noticed a little bit of a difference. And so maybe last year was true to form. Maybe we should have predicted it. I don't know. Has anyone else got a better answer for that? Anyone else want to waffle around it like I did?
There's now several more insurers who own as one of their investment assets another health insurer. Do you have any views about whether that might play up in this kind of table in future?
Yeah, interesting. I guess I hadn't thought about it too much. I suppose that goes to the slide on general insurance issues and that as organisations get more complex, then there's risks because to not lose your shirt, you have to keep both insurers on an even keel. Maybe it increases the chances of risk. I guess, though, that the sort of investments people are going into are, if you're going to diversify and you're a health insurer, I guess the least risk thing to diversify into might be another health insurer. You know, so it's people are going into things where they have expertise. So it's harder to find a health, or they're going to health services, or so they're diversifying into very much aligned fields, and maybe diversification reduces risk to an extent. I don't know, but maybe you'd be more concerned if insurers didn't diversify. Maybe you'd be more concerned if they did diversify, but they went into, I don't know, liability insurance or US insurance or what have you. But time will tell. No, thanks, Rob. Thanks.
I agree with David that this is a more risky time in the industry than we faced since perhaps 2007. Ignoring investment-related issues, which fortunately for the industry, you know, during the GFC there weren't many insurers, and you know, some of us worked hard with those insurers that did have issues to resolve the issues promptly. So the risks are elevated, and of course the main risk is one that, you know, we haven't talked about at all, and that is that the industry's products are getting too expensive for consumers, particularly the consumers we need to have, younger, healthier consumers. And so the Minister's definitely on the right track, in my opinion, and she supports the proposition I put to the Institute in 2013, that this Institute needed to lead the industry in helping it deal with that issue. Now, we're going to have the problems that come from the lack of affordability, and we all, you know those. David's, no, it was perhaps you. It was David. David who referred to Medibank Private, I think, yeah, and the policyholder turnover. So, and I think as well, from what I've seen, the projection models that we as actuaries use perhaps aren't as sophisticated as they might need to be in an environment where policyholders are shifting more than they have in the past. The models have perhaps relied on stability. So, yes, so for future risks, which are the more important things, the other thing I should say is obviously the industry is also characterised by some very small insurers that generally won't be as resilient as a larger entity, may or may not be as resilient as a larger entity. Just as a general point, you know, we don't need to discuss it at all, but my gut feel is the same as David's, that there's increased risk, and I think it extends beyond the comments that David made that I agree with, by the way.
And I guess, again, the question Stuart raised is relevant around what does lose your shirt mean? So which of the definitions? So from an APRA point of view, perhaps if, you know, we lost 25% of people covered and the price has increased quite a bit, you know, maybe capital adequacy on a technical basis might increase because less people covered, less capital. But in terms of, you know, sustaining your business as an investor in PHI or what have you, then I mean, you have lost your shirt at that point. So the sort of the lens is relevant. I guess another issue in mind is, a hot word at the moment is disruption and digital disruption, and you know what that might look like in our industry. So even if we do have the tools to look at some of these risks, you know, what are the complete left field risks that could come to us? Quite hard to think what it might be given some of the regulatory protections and other protections around the industry, but maybe that's why it's worrying, because we don't know what it is.
Maybe I can add to that. You know, if currently, I guess there's a bit of talk on affordability and community rating and risk equalization as a sort of underpinning foundation of all that. So if that was to change in a material way, that could upset prices and cause lots of members to move around different products and be, you know, upsetting a stable membership base. So that will make things really hard to predict and price. So I think that's, you know, possibly medium, longish term, if the government or regulators have the political will to get it to happen, that could be a potential, a new thing to add to your list of, you know, what drives pricing errors.
Or conversely, you know, if the response to affordability is to drive more people into the industry and encourage more uptake of PHI, that also brings its risks, of course, and maybe that's where some of the previous instances come from. I guess without putting anybody on the spot in particular, I know there are some people in the room from the regulator, and if any of them feel like making any comments or observations, I know we always enjoy listening to them, so feel free to jump in. Any hands going up? No.
I could talk a little bit about the move to APRA. Will a move from FIAC to APRA change capital management over time? In the general sense, I wouldn't think so. I mean, the capital management plan is firmly established and everyone recognises what it is. It's to allow for that additional capital over the minimum that is appropriate for the risk profile of the insurer, which you quite rightly pointed out earlier is quite different for a lot of the insurers. And APRA's been spending a lot of time with other industries in recent years, the life insurers and the general insurers, looking at ICAPs and all that sort of stuff. So that same principle, we've sort of been taking the same sort of considerations forward with PHIs as well. So I don't think that's going to make a big change. You talk about their earlier correlation between weaknesses and key relationships. So we would expect that with the actuarial involvement in a lot of the capital management, that would strengthen it and make it a lot more robust. And improved risk management, mitigating the drivers of failure going forward. Again, with the actuaries being involved and giving advice on risk management side, we would expect that to be helping going forward again too. As you would know, APRA's been looking at capital standards, well, looking at all the standards for PHIs, and we've been putting most of our focus into the qualitative sort of governance side of things with the PHIs, and I think that's going to be the focus going forward, is just making sure that what we expect of other regulated entities will have something very similar for PHIs going forward, because there's no logical reason to have inconsistency across the industries in that sort of area. So that's probably all I can say just at the moment, I think.
I guess you mentioned ICAP as well, and I'm trying to think of a question that doesn't put you on the spot, within general insurance, do you think ICAP is helpful to stop general insurers losing their shirt?
Well, I think the ICAP has been very helpful, because if only what it's done is sort of regularise and actually put down clearly what perhaps was just thinking, background thinking, assumed knowledge, this is the way we do things here type of approach in many insurers. So now it's there, it's in writing, and as you say, it's so much of it's very much around not what are the absolute levels of capital so much as what do you do when you're approaching a level of capital, how quickly do you actually do something about it, is it actually monitored, and who does it, and so on and so on. So that, I think, is where it becomes very valuable. It makes people think a lot more on a day-to-day basis about capital rather than it's a number we have to check every now and again to see that we're still okay. And that sort of approach, you know, whether mandated or not, is, I would think, should be the same in PHI because it's the same concept. It's do we have enough capital for our risk? And if our risk appetite changes because we suddenly take on a new product or we buy a subsidiary or whatever, how do we react to that in terms of managing capital?
Yeah. Thanks, Robert. Sophie?
Thank you. I'll probably put a little bit of observation on the CMP because previously I was in FIAC doing a bit of review on insurer CMP. For some some observation. I found like some insurer mentioned that CMP was a very good exercise for them to think about what their key risks are and then determine their key target capital. They found it very useful, but some of the insurer will say it's more like a regulatory type of exercise, so they didn't really make better use. They could have appreciated that exercise more. So I was wondering, like, for anyone who is here now, do we have any ideas like how insurer can better improve the CMP or this type of exercise to better manage their capital?
So ideas to improve the CMP or any suggestions along that line? Or any other more general comments on? I know there are a couple there.
I won't answer your question, Sophie, but I guess maybe part of it is that we're taking a journey of baby steps here. And so, first of all, we had to educate directors about capital and about what it actually means in a health insurer. And then we had to educate them on stress scenarios and what sort of things can go wrong and what's the quantum of some of those things going wrong. And we're really only, what, 2 or 3 years in. So I think it'll be a series of iterations to ongoing improvement. And I guess it'll be up to us and people who mix around different insurers. They can share best practice. They can share their observations about what works when things go wrong. And perhaps there's an opportunity here for the Actuaries Institute to kind of share better practice and help drive better practice through papers. I have a different question. So I've got the mic, so I have that right. I missed your opening remarks, Jamie, but what were your objectives in writing this paper and have they been met? Like, one of the things for me, I guess, is kind of an education piece, but it might be for people who are not in this room. So do you have any observations about how it's gone? And
yeah, so I guess the purpose was just to encourage discussion and part of that, I suppose, is discussion amongst ourselves. To sort of pick up Robert's words, used in a different context. You know, maybe these are all things we know, but by putting it in one place, maybe this and you know, having a talk about it is useful. I guess primarily though, the audience is outside PHI actuaries. It's people who look at our industry from afar, know a few things about the industry, and then pass verdict on whether we've got enough capital or not. And maybe that's done in the context of a pricing round or maybe not. And maybe it's done from a general insurance perspective. And perhaps the answer to has it achieved that aim might be the same as your response earlier. You know, I think it helps a little bit, but I think it's helpful to keep explaining why our capital is the way it is. And I suppose we're starting a discussion that in, you know, maybe it culminates in the APRA review of capital standards in a few years so that, you know, everybody's very comfortable by that point with, you know, what are the risks and how do they differ from other APRA-regulated industries. Or maybe it's something that sort of gets life at pricing rounds when industry average return on capital stats are quoted. Maybe this might be help people understand why insurers need capital.
So extensive media campaign then?
No. I can't see it getting the front page of anything.
It seems to me that, I mean, we're talking about a lot of technical risks here, but it, as an observer, former regulator and now a director of a health fund, I actually think the single largest risk to this industry is a sovereign risk for a lack of understanding with the policy people in the Department of Health. I would comment, when I was at FEAC, we regularly used to run Health Insurance 101 for the new officer in the department that was coming in as the policy advisor, and that is still happening. APRA, you now have risk of making sure that the people that are advising the minister actually understand it. I don't believe there's a huge amount of understanding of health insurance at the moment, exhibited by the issue around the prosthetics list and the lack of understanding of what that means, and also the minister's reaction to the excess capital. Excess capital has a very specific meaning within insurance areas. The minister and her advisers thought that meant too much capital. It's not the same thing at all. And the debate was going past each other in parallel lines, several kilometres apart. So I think there's a huge risk for the industry and for the actuaries around making sure that the policymakers actually understand what they're talking about.
Mm.
Because we, in the end, as directors of health insurance funds, are trying to provide a product within the requirements of the regulator that's affordable, effective, and do all of the right things. And I'm in a not-for-profit insurer, so our business is about looking after our members, not the shareholders' capital.
Yeah, thanks, Gail. And I mean, that did come through in the data that it's sovereign risk. I guess, unfortunately, you know, capital doesn't mitigate sovereign risk. In fact, the more capital you have, the more sovereign risk you have, it seems. I guess what mitigates it, as you say, is informing people, and I guess that's, you know, we can all have our role. Carl?
Just a comment around the pricing errors, and I'm getting back into the industry, so still trying to figure out what's happened the last couple of years, but I think pricing errors may be a little bit harsh in terms of the term. From what I've seen, a lot of the times when you're looking at insurers have maybe got themselves into difficulty, and obviously around prices, is that it's based on, you know, the existing membership and the existing claiming patterns. So the way that I think about it is more around, well, how has that membership changed and how have those claiming patterns changed? And trying to identify those sort of triggers and monitor those and manage those going forward. So when we, you know, and you know, a lot of other points around there about duration and monitoring claiming patterns by that. But when we talk about growth and the effects, potential adverse effects of growth, in my mind, I think we have an existing membership. So you're priced based on that claiming pattern. But one, you have new members coming in, so it's very difficult to be definitive that claiming pattern is going to be the same, and therefore those prices will be the same. And two, if you are able to grow at high rates, there's a chance that the reason you're able to grow so quickly is because your prices are below the market. Maybe you've come up with a great distribution model that, you know, can target very low-risk members, and maybe you've got something that can justify any sort of price above the market. If it's not that, but one of the ways that this has played out is that products do come into the market that are either below the market, or that they were below the market and then tried to grow, assuming they can keep their rates the same. Some comments.
All good comments, Carl. Thanks. And So we're doing our prices at the moment, which will be effective through to March 18, and as at March 18, you know, we don't know who's going to be covered by our funds at March 18. And we don't know if what their medical conditions are going to be at March. And you know, maybe sometimes they do, but generally they don't either. So, I mean, in the context of that, I suppose errors is a hard word to use. Okay. So we've been going for a while on the Q&A. I'm glad so many people pitched in. It's good to have some discussion. I can take a couple more, or we could leave it there. Yes, David.
I suppose just one thing. Your comment around this is really aimed at people outside the industry. One of the things you didn't have up there with the difference between PHI and GI is the nature of the companies that are selling the product, and the fact that the dominant vehicle within private health insurance, by number of insurers, not necessarily market share, is a mutual not-for-profit model, which is quite different to general insurance and life insurance. And that creates a whole lot of separate issues around capital and availability of capital and who you're really responsible to and those sorts of things. And I think, again, one of the issues we're seeing is, and particularly now Medibank's listed, it's just going to change the industry quite dramatically in its approach, and everybody's focusing on Medibank, even though NIB's been there for a while. But I just really wonder, you know, over time and as, you know, the risks, you know, that come into this industry and the pressure and affordability and all that, how does this industry react when it's predominantly, you know, a lot of the smaller mutuals, not-for-profits, access to capital and those sorts of things? You know, everybody thinks the shareholder model has access to capital, but quite clearly if things aren't going great, you know, in some respects, probably there's probably two insurers out there, maybe Doctors and Bupa, that are part of big mutual organisations, are probably the ones with the greatest access to capital potentially. The smaller mutuals that are just on their own, their capitals have got to come from their policyholders, and Medibank and NIB at the end of the day comes from shareholders, and they may not be willing to put it in if things aren't going well. So, you know, there's a whole lot of different structures there that are quite different to the general insurance industry, and you sort of wonder over time, in 10 years' time, what this industry is going to look like. You know, whether philosophically, you know, it's a mutual, health should always be mutual. You know, it shouldn't be a shareholder, you know, organisation, you know, your Ramsays and those things. You can argue that till the cows come home. So again, I think that's just if you were trying to explain it. And again, it comes back to the issue of excess capital and those sorts of discussions. You know, what is excess capital? I just think that's probably part of the discussion, again, that differentiates this industry a bit from some of the other industries, not rightly or wrongly, but just different.
Yeah. I suppose we were light touch on that, I suppose. I mean, predominantly we were at the risk end of, you know, what causes the distress, but I take your point that, you know, the ability to deal with that or the, you know, how you may choose to deal with that and all the steps that come after that, you know, the structure is very much relevant to that. So, yeah, that would be a logical next step.
So I've got a couple of questions, I guess. The first one was about, you mentioned in the presentation earlier that pricing can react quite quickly in PHI compared to GI. I mean, compared to long tail, certainly, but given it can often take a year or two for the full experience to come through, and then you have that year or so delay in getting new prices approved and implemented, is that, for a larger fund, that's not too much of a risk, but for the smaller funds, is there more risk there from that? And I guess the second one was, how does the health.com.au situation differ from the ones that were used in this study?
Okay. So I mean, others may have responses too, but my response would be, so there's a number of levers health insurers have got. So the most immediate lever would be you can change benefits with 60 days notice. So if I go to QBE and insure my home, I'd sign up for a year, and that's it. You're on the hook for a year. So you might decide after 6 months that I'm undercharged, but my price is locked in and my terms are locked in, whereas health insurers can effectively change the terms with notice, even if you've prepaid. So I suppose that's one of the levers that let you react a little bit quicker. And I guess health.com.au, I guess, I mean, we've all seen sort of different snippets of that, so we'd all have our own take. But, I mean, no policyholders were harmed. I mean, it's been in the press that the investors didn't necessarily do too well, as is some of the things that's been reported. But I don't know, ask a health.com.au customer how they're going, and they had a pretty good deal for a few years, and no one lost money.
Jamie, to me, health.com.au is an example of the one I was saying about the competitive pressures, that to break into the market, they had to compete. They choose to do that by being prominent on a supermarket shelves for health insurance. The basis on which they were able to do that meant that it was difficult to get the kind of returns that were required for them to compete, not in the health insurance market, but in the capital market. And the investors, in the end, chose not to keep investing in that particular way of competing in the private health insurance market. So to me, it's an example of how the inexorable competition, if you choose to compete on an unsustainable basis, you'll lose money.
Sorry, just one thing to Stuart's point of view. So since, as he addressed, there was insurer unable to cope up with the competition, right? So that was part of the underpricing issue that you that was at the beginning of the slides. So that was one thing I was always curious about. So since there was a competition in the market, as David said, there was now it's very transparent. Like and also you can see from the aggregator the prices are quite transparent. And also, as many of you said, there was a political risk as well, because insurers constantly under the pressure from the minister. So do or any of you have any ideas about how it's going to be sustained? Again, as David said, there was some not-for-profit insurers. They have access of capital, but those capital will be used up one day if it's not going to be a sustainable thing. So any ideas or any views of how it will look like in the future? So, or any suggestions?
So is the question around sort of ability to sustain low prices for competitive advantage? Is that the... Yeah, I guess that's sort of where it all comes back to, isn't it? The recipe for problems being around pricing and capital management with government government intervention. So I'm not sure anyone would like to make a response. I think we might all be talked out, Sophie. I think it's a good question. We might have to take that one for another day, or maybe we'll start the Melbourne session with something on that track. Okay. Anyone else, or we'll draw a line? Okay. Well, thank you everyone for coming, particularly those who've travelled further than others. Still a few sandwiches left if you're still hungry. Otherwise, I'll see you all in Melbourne. Okay.